Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Today we're joined by Bill Gatton. He is one of the few true in the trenches creative financing teachers who actually practices what he preaches. A highly successful real estate investor and much sought after national speaker, Bill's most recent book of many on the subject is a very comprehensive, humorous, and irreverent Making It Big in Creative Real Estate and Keeping It This Time. Bill, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Bruce. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. It's always been very enjoyable getting a chance to speak with you on occasion, and this is the first chance I get to interview you.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm too. How long has the concept of holding title to properties in a trust been around?
Well, basically, in the United States, it's been around for about 100 years. People don't really know much about it, even including attorneys and even including real estate attorneys. But the land trust, per se, has been in the U.S. since Henry Ford back in the turn of the century. And then the Illinois land trust, which is the model that you in use today, was actually created about 1920. And interestingly enough, it was created for one Mr. Capone in Illinois, and still known there by a lot of the older attorneys as the Mafia Trust.
Well, I know now at least I got one question wrong on your test. You have in the mid-70s, interest rates were very reasonable, and then by 1980 they were 15%. How did this pose a problem for the lenders?
Well, in the mid-70s, I was in the equipment leasing business at the time. And I know that at the time that mortgage rates were at their highest ever, that the real estate market was taking a dive, kind of like it is now. So
yes.
The problem with lenders is always that their interest rates increasingly prevent people from borrowing money, prevent people from buying houses, and when the lenders can't loan, then the only thing they can do is increase their rates and increase their approval parameters, which just kind of exacerbates the whole problem, which essentially is happening right now with this so-called subprime meltdown that's going on. But the lenders are hurting now because they're having to take so many properties back, and their inventory is just so extraordinarily large that they can never hope to make any monies on these properties they're foreclosing on.
You know me in statistics, so I was always wondering why we didn't have a big price decrease in the early 80s, because we had a lot of foreclosures, and in 81 and 82. About 60% of all real estate transactions did not need new financing.
Yeah.
They were able to walk the old financing forward, and that created, I think, the need for, or what they thought the need for, was the Garn-St-Germain Act in 1982. The passing of that, what was significant about the Garn-St-Germain Act?
Well, the Garn-St-Germain Act is misunderstood by a lot of people. In other words, most people will presume that the Garn-St-Germain Act was passed in order to protect lenders from the horrible borrowers that are taking advantage of them. But what actually happened with Senator Jake Garn and Ferdinand Germain is they saw it the other way around. They needed to do something that could protect the consumer against the giant financial industry. So what they did in creating it, the legislation is known as the Federal Depository Institutions Act. What they did is prevent the lenders from foreclosing on certain due-on-sale clauses. For example, a lender could no longer foreclose because somebody got married and changed the title of the property from themselves to them and their spouse. Or the lenders could no longer foreclose because someone would die and the property would be granted to the surviving spouse, which is what they were doing many times in the past. So with Garn-St-Germain, it turned out then that the lenders can once and for all foreclose on their security interest in the property as long as they don't hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the exclusions were, you can't foreclose because somebody dies or somebody gets married. You can't foreclose because someone gives the property to their immediate family member. And one of those exclusions was they can't foreclose if somebody decides to put their property into a living trust. As long as the trust is a revocable trust and created during the lifetime of the borrower and so forth. So that kind of is what puts us on the map, is the fact that we can transfer properties by use of a trust without worrying about the loan being called for a due-on-sale violation.
Back then, I doubt that they had a living trust document. So, in other words, there wasn't the kind of document that's in existence now where people deed their property for basically tax protection purposes. So the kind of trust that you're talking about was probably this Illinois Land Trust?
Well, the trust that they were referring to more than likely is what's so loosely called now the Inter Vivos Trust. It's an asset protection family trust.
Okay.
It's called a fully funded asset protection trust. That's what they were referring to in Garden St. Germain. But the Inter Vivos Trust, or the family trust, really doesn't have any real protections. It's just a way to avoid your heirs having to pay off your creditors when you die. But the thing is that any trust that's created to take effect during the lifetime of the grantor or the person setting up the trust is a living trust, and it is an Inter Vivos Trust. So an Illinois-type land trust is just another model of the living trust, the difference being that in most trusts, it's the trustee who is in charge, whereas in a land trust, it's the beneficiary themselves who are in charge. So if Bruce Norris sets up a Bruce Norris land trust, he can give the full and complete ownership of his property to the trustee, but still, as the beneficiary, remain 100% in control and in charge of anything that happens to the property, including keeping the income tax benefits and the potential for appreciation and all of the what's called the fee simple bundle of rights in real estate ownership without giving up anything.
You know, everyone in the real estate business is pretty sure they know how real estate's supposed to be transferred. I mean, they know that. And that's a paradigm that everybody's pretty entrenched with. Has that caused problems with this idea of, no, there might be another and even superior way of doing it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's like anything. Anytime there's a new idea that comes along, people who make their living from the old idea are going to have difficulty with it. We always say that every good idea goes through the three phases. One of them is ridicule, and then it's active opposition, and then finally acceptance of self-evident. So we're somewhere in between two and three there. But the idea of transferring ownership in an asset by trust has been around forever, I mean, for at least 500 years. And a lot of people do it without considering the analogy between it and the land trust. A lot of people will create a corporation to sell their business. In other words, rather than selling the business, they'll sell stock in the corporation and walk away, and the corporation is not disturbed, and the business is. Years ago, and I don't know if they do it now or not, but the way to sell, in California at least, the way to sell a liquor store, which is non-transferable. When you got a liquor license, you could never transfer the liquor license to anybody else. But the way to do it in those days was you go and put the liquor store in a corporation and leave the liquor license with the corporation and just sell stock in the corporation to a new buyer. That way the new buyer could come in and take over the liquor store with the license fully intact.
I see.
So that's kind of what we do with real estate, is we have an owner of the property who wants to sell it and is having difficulty doing it the traditional way. We'll have him put the property into an Illinois-type land trust, and then rather than selling the house, we'll have him just name somebody as a co-beneficiary in the trust and then give them the benefits of ownership. They get 100% of all the same benefits that any owner would have, plus they have the added value of almost perfect asset protection in terms of protection against lawsuits and divorce and death and dying and all that.
How well do lawyers understand the concept of the trust?
If you found 100 attorneys today at random, you'd probably find maybe 10 of those who knew a lot about trusts.
Okay.
And then if you find 100 of those 10 who know a lot about trust, you might find one who understands land trust. And even at that, you probably wouldn't. Land trusts are thought of by attorneys to be an Illinois device. In other words, I've had dozens of attorneys say to me, I know what a land trust is, but it's only good in Illinois.
Okay.
Which is not at all true. Land trust is acceptable in every state in the United States, and there's only two who don't acknowledge it as anything different than an ordinary grantor's trust, and that's Louisiana and Tennessee. But even in those states, it's certainly legal to create a beneficiary-directed inter vivos trust.
What about realtors? They have the same problem?
Well, the problem that realtors have oftentimes is they're working for companies whose attorneys are hired not to take any chances. In other words, if you take a company like Coldwell Banker or Remax or something, the attorneys that they hire are hired so that they stay strictly on the straight and narrow, no matter what. No matter how good or bad something is, they don't want to move off of that line. So, yeah, we've encountered resistance in working with realtors in the past, although we have worked with thousands and thousands of them. But there are many companies that, when they review what we're doing, they say, well, that's not a part of what we're used to seeing. Therefore, rather than having to go back to law school or read another book, let's just say no and not do it.
Well,
it's a shame, but that is what happened.
In the last downturn, in the 90 to 97, you had some very successful realtors understand the concept and do very well in California.
Yeah, we had dozens and dozens of realtors who were making virtually millions of dollars in commissions where other people were going broke because they understood our concepts. And one in particular was Prudential Real Estate out in Lancaster and Palmdale. The broker there pulled in about $2.5 million in net commissions on transactions in Lancaster and Palmdale, where almost all of the real estate companies were going broke during that last recession. And then we had people down in the Riverside area, down where you are, with Century 21 and Remax and Coldwell Banker, making thousands and thousands of dollars on commissions and not even feeling the recession because they knew how to do what we do.
Now, what's unique about that to me is that in 90, let's say interest rates were 10%, and by the time we got to 96, they were about 7.5%. So most of the financing that was on the existing properties was higher than the current rate, and you still were able to have transactions work even though the properties were probably virtually no equity.
Well, most of the properties were either very minimal equity or no equity, but the reason it works is because the seller has some options. In a situation like that, the seller can say, well, I'll let you in. The payments are going to be a little bit higher, but because you don't have the greatest credit in the world and because you don't have a lot of cash, I'll let you in the property if you can make the higher payments.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people think that's just great because if they can get by without having to come up with a down payment, then they don't mind having the payment be higher. It would be if they went and borrowed a down payment anyway. And in other cases, the sellers can sit back and analyze their cost and their risk and say, well, the payment's too high and I'll make a portion of the payment myself. The payment's $2,000. It should be only $1,700. So I'll pay $300 a month of that just in order to get rid of the house.
Okay.
And a lot of times the sellers will come in with money up front. In other words, the seller looks to see that it's going to cost him in income tax on debt relief $50,000. Well, then he'd rather put in $20,000 up front to assist somebody into getting the house.
Okay.
And maybe in many cases even get that $20,000 back 6 or 7 years from now when the house is ready to be refinanced or sold.
The trust is really still not a mainstream item, but there's a few other options that people go to. So let's talk about the problems if they went that route. Let's talk about doing a lease option. I'm an owner of a property that's basically got no equity, and I want to try and get off of at least some of the payments. So I give somebody a lease option. Is that a problem if that's a long option?
Well, a lease option, even if it's a short option, is always a problem from some standpoint. For example, a lot of the people out there, real estate professionals, are not aware that a simple lease option violates a lender's due on sale clause. In other words, in every loan, the loan, whether it's state, federal, or private, the loan is going to have an alienation clause that says, if you create an option on this property, you violated the due on sale clause, and we have the right to call the loan immediately due and payable. And it'll also say that if you lease the property for more than 3 years, we have the right to call the loan due and payable. So in terms of lease options, you know, I'm just adamantly opposed to them for those reasons. One thing is, in a lease option, you can't evict somebody if they don't make the payments. If there's an option and they've acquired by any means some of the equity in the property by a discounted option fee or by rent credits or whatever it might be, they can't be evicted. They have to be foreclosed on, and that can be a long, arduous, expensive process.
Right. That's not the foreclosure we're used to doing. That's a judicial process.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
What about contract for deeds?
Well, it's the same thing. A contract for deed is essentially a layaway plan, and if a contract for deed is done properly, there really isn't any benefit for the person who would be called the vendee, the person who is living in the property and making the payments. With a contract for deed, you don't get the deed to the property. You don't get the legal title to the property until you've paid for it. In other words, you get it all paid off, and then you get the deed to the property. Well, in the process, there is no tax benefit to the buyer, the vendee, and also there's a due-on-sale violation as far as the lender is concerned. And also, if somebody doesn't make a payment, they can't be evicted because they've acquired equity in the property, and they're going to have to be foreclosed upon with unlawful detainer actions and judicial foreclosure processes and so forth. Now, as far as the contract for deed that we see most often, it's a contract for sale more than a contract for deed, or excuse me, a contract of sale, and where the buyer, the vendee, comes in and actually takes the income tax write-off. Well, then there is no question about the due-on-sale issue. And taking an income tax write-off means they obviously have an equitable interest in the property and are impossible to evict. And in a case like that, anybody's liens, lawsuits, judgments, death, dying, marital disputes will attach directly to the property long after they're out of it. So it's just anytime there's a good alternative, then the contract for deed becomes a far, far less desirable way to get the same thing done.
Okay. Let's talk about the steps in a transaction where a trust will be used to purchase a property. I would think a very common one would be right now we have somebody that is in foreclosure. And for the sake of this example, let's say that they have a 10% equity position. I run an ad and they call up. What is the process that I would take them through and protect myself as far as the civil codes that apply to California?
Now, we're referring to a foreclosure that you're going to purchase, not a situation you're going to try to bail the owner out and leave him in the property, sir.
No, let's solve it the way you would solve it using what you know. And because I'm not that creative. So I would be in the buying business, and you're going to do it a different way. You're going to leave. Let's go through the example where he actually gets to stay in the property.
Well, we don't advocate doing that very often.
Okay.
The reason that we don't is because it's the number one source of litigation right now. There's a lot of, pardon the expression, but a lot of mooch attorneys out there who set themselves up as consumer affairs advocates, and they go around looking for people who've been evicted from their property and who got involved with an investor who says, I'll cure the loan for you, leave you in the property, and you can continue having the benefits. Just give me part of the future appreciation, or give me something in return. And chances of getting sued in a circumstance like that is about 99%. You're probably going to get sued. The only time we would do it is where we had somebody who is totally trustworthy, completely capable of making the payments, and who knows exactly what the property's worth, and we would go in and leave all of their equity 100% intact. We'd have them set up a trust and then lease the property from the trust before they involve us. And then we would come in, bring the loan current, and be involved as a co-beneficiary in the trust, designated to receive some portion of the future sale price 5, 6, 7 years from now. And in a case like that, we would also contribute to their monthly payment. We'd put in an extra $1,200 into escrow so that their monthly payment, whatever it might be, could be reduced by $100. What we want to do is, if we ever ended up in court, is to be able to say to the judge clearly that we did not increase their payments in a time of need. We did not take any of their equity. We left their equity intact. The only thing we were interested in is the potential for some future appreciation at a reasonable rate and so on, and, of course, getting our money back that we paid to bring the loan current.
Okay.
On occasion like that, it can be done, but we certainly don't recommend novices even think about trying it.
Okay. So before we get too far in, let's talk about the language that's very familiar with you, but not to everybody. The players that are involved in a trust transaction.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about who is a trustee, first of all, and what do they get to do?
Well, the trustee and a land trust, in one of our transactions, is a company that we use in Northern California. It's Equity Holding Corporation. They're a third-party trustee for land trusts only. They're bonded and licensed to function as a third-party trustee. So the players in a trust are, first of all, the person we would call the settlor. That's the person who owns the house, who's setting up the affairs of the trust. Then the next entity involved is the beneficiary. That's the person who's going to get the benefit that comes from that trust. And then the third entity involved is the trustee. So the trustee holds the title for the benefit of the beneficiary. And in a land trust model, it's the beneficiaries then who have the full directive and management power over the property and over the trustee.
Okay.
And then, of course, the asset in the trust is considered the other corner of that. The property in the trust that would legally would be called the corpus of the trust. Now, that's the property. So if I put a property in a land trust, I'm the settlor, and then I name myself as a beneficiary, and then I would appoint Equity Holding Corporations as the person I'm trusting to hold the title to my property. Now, one of our transactions, which would be called a net trust or any H trust, Equity Holding Trust, I would then say, you want a house to live in, so I would say, okay, I'm going to appoint you, my Bruce Norris, as a co-beneficiary in this trust. And as far as the property is concerned, you can just lease the property from the trust on what's called a triple net basis. In other words, you'd pay all the payments and the insurance and property tax and what have you. And by virtue of setting it up that way, now you, as that co-beneficiary who's leasing the property, you now have 100% of the fee simple benefits of owning real estate. That use, occupancy, possession, water rights, mineral rights, quiet enjoyment, everything that goes along with owning real estate. Plus, as I said before, you also have the added, tremendous added benefit of almost perfect asset protection as far as that property is concerned.
How important is the choice of a trustee?
Well, it's very important. A lot of people who teach the concept of land trust are not doing what we do. So they'll suggest that if you wanted to transfer a property by trust, it's okay to be your own trustee. Or it's okay to name your next-door neighbor or somebody else personally as a trustee. The problem with doing that, if it's not just for 30 days or something, the problem with doing that is an individual would have no idea how to handle inquiring parties. If an attorney called to get information, which is supposed to be private, the individual would probably buckle under with threats and so on. And also, the individual wouldn't have any idea to handle the income tax accounting and all of that. So we always recommend, if it's more than 30 or 40 days or 60 days, we recommend using only a corporate trustee so that it can't die and get the property tied up in its probate. And also a corporate trustee that is licensed and bonded and is thoroughly and totally committed to the trust concept and knows exactly what to do under times of stress and duress.
Bill, we are at the end of this segment. What would be the website that you could give people to go to your company?
Well, I would say, our website is landtrust.net, and they're certainly welcome to go there.
Okay.
Landtrust.net.
Oh.
And then we also have prorealestatesource.com for people who want to advertise properties or want to pick up buyers and so forth.
Okay.
So landtrust.net and prorealestatesource.com.
All right. Bill, thank you very much, and we will pick this up on our next show.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com. Check out www.thenorrisgroup.com for upcoming live speaking engagements and education opportunities in May and June, including the Norris Group's REO Boot Camp. Visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or call 951-780-5856 today for more information. 951-780-5856.